Everybody. Welcome back, Rishin Sama. So, you may think I'm a little obsessive telling all the stories in this koan collection, but I was just remembering it's actually a very traditional thing to do, especially in the schools that really study koans as meditation objects. That's pretty much all the talks are, ever. So anyway, just wanted you to know this is legit. And in a way, it makes it easier to prepare the talk, so I know what I'm going to talk about. Well, I know the topic, I guess, but otherwise it makes it much harder. Because what are you going to say? Anyway, the 21st case of the Mumonkon is about like deeply responding to whatever it is that's calling. You know, sometimes called the inmost request. What is life really calling for from you? Or, it's interesting the way that word calling gets turned around too, like what is your calling? So here's the story. Ananda asked Mahakashyapa, "The world-honored one transmitted to you the golden brocade robe. Did he give you anything else?" Mahakashyapa called out, "Ananda!" "Yes," answered Ananda. "Knock down the flagpole at the gate," said Mahakashyapa. So the student is Ananda in this case, and Mahakashyapa is his teacher. Ananda asked Mahakashyapa, "The world-honored one transmitted to you the golden brocade robe. What else did he give you? Did he give you anything else?" Mahakashyapa called out his name, "Ananda." "Yes," answered Ananda. "Knock down the flagpole at the gate," said Mahakashyapa. So Ananda was the Buddha's younger cousin, probably, and who was his attendant, his jisha, for 20-something years. And he's said to have had like a perfect memory. And probably they all had better memories than we do now because they didn't have Google, you know. So they could really, didn't have anything else that they really would focus on what they heard. But even in the standard of the time, Ananda had a very good memory. And he was almost always by the Buddha's side when the Buddha would give talks. And Ananda memorized every single one. And so if you read the early teachings, they always start with a stock phrase, which is, thus have I heard. And so you're supposed to be hearing it in Ananda's voice. He's recalling, telling you what he heard. Thus have I heard. Later sutras where they wanted to make sure it sounded legit, they'd start it with that, whether Ananda was around or not. And even if Ananda wasn't by the Buddha's side, he would ask, it would be high pressure on the other monks because they would know that Ananda would come along a little while later and say, "Well, what did the Buddha say?" You know, and he would not settle for a summary. You had to really tell him. So they all were on their toes, listening very carefully to these teachings. But what I've always appreciated about Ananda is not that he could do that, which is amazing, but also that he was so diligent and devoted in his practice and that he kept going, even though in some fundamental way, he just didn't get it. Like he knew all this stuff and he could recite it. It was a little more like book knowledge or something, but he somehow didn't feel like he quite understood the meaning, you know. What's the true meaning of this? He didn't quite understand. Or you could say, if you use the language of awakening, he wasn't awakened. He wasn't fully enlightened or awake. He's like really close for a long, long time. So I don't know, I kind of relate. Can you relate to that? You know? You're like, I almost get this. It's the tip of my tongue. And not, I almost get this like there's something I'm supposed to understand in Buddhism or, you know, something. But like I almost get this thing called me, you know what I mean? I almost get it, but I don't quite get it. So this is a Zen story, and in the Zen story, there is a line of transmission from one teacher to one disciple, and on it goes until the present day. And on Saturday, in the Jukai, receiving the precepts ceremony, we'll give papers to the people who are receiving the precepts that, you know, show where this came from, because the precepts are one of the teachings that's being passed from teacher to disciple. And it has a whole big long list of names on there. I always forget how many, 100 and something. Not that many, really, to go back 2,600 years. You know. So in the Zen story, Ananda is in this story receiving something from his teacher. But it's worth knowing that the early Buddhist story is actually pretty different. These are all good stories, though, that we should know and appreciate. In the early Buddhist story, after the Buddha died, he did not have one particular disciple. He had a whole little group of them. There's different lists of the great disciples, but about a dozen. And after he died, because there was no one teacher, it created a challenge. The disciples had to kind of figure out, what are we doing? You know, what's next? And so they wanted to clarify what all the teachings were. So they didn't have the Buddha ask anymore, right? So they had to, like, they wanted to have, so just like us, just like we would do, they said, let's have a meeting. So they had a big meeting called the First Buddhist Council. Later it was called that. And they had a problem, though, with their meeting. They realized that the only people who should be at this meeting to deeply understand and compare notes about the true meaning of Buddhist teachings are the ones who are awake, you know? Who really get it, who are fully arhats, is the term they used. But Ananda wasn't there yet. But they also couldn't do it without Ananda, because he was the only one who remembered all this stuff. So it was like really a messed up situation. They were all freaking out. But they had to call the meeting anyway. People had to gather from a distance. I forget how long after the Buddha's death this was. Sometime after. So they had to set the date and have the meeting anyway, figuring, oh, we'll figure it out somehow. But luckily, the night before the meeting, Ananda was deeply, you know, he was practicing passionately, right? He, like, he knew that the entire unfolding of his teacher's, you know, lineage would depend on him, kind of. So anyway, he was practicing so carefully and so seriously that when his head hit the pillow going to bed the night before the First Great Council, he got it. He was awake. So it all worked out. But in the Zen story, we have this lovely idea of one teacher transmitting to one student, or transmitting to more than one student, but in the end, there's important lines of transmission. Series of ancestors and disciples. And even if that doesn't always exactly meet historical truth, it is also true. It is also a very true teaching, I think. That there's something that happens when you practice with somebody for decades, study together, as we're trying to do here in our little way. Sometimes we say that the teachings are passed on from, like, warm hand to warm hand. Or other times we say, your eyebrows interlock, you know. So I got good eyebrows for this. There's many signs of Buddhas. I can't remember if eyebrows are on the list or not. They might be. But it's interesting, you know, in my case, and probably in your case too, I don't know what exactly I received from my teacher. I can't really tell you what that is. But there is something, you know, there's something to it. Something about your teachers, my teacher's trust and blessing and a deep connection in the Dharma is just a powerful medicine. And it helps you keep going. It helps me keep going. So even if I don't really know what I'm doing and I can't exactly describe what Norman, my teacher, passed on to me, there's something that was offered. And something that I was somehow able to at least partially receive. So it is really true. So in this, and there's a prior Zen story that we talked about a long time ago, which did the previous link in the Zen transmission chain, which was from Buddha to Mahakashyapa, who is now the teacher in this story. So he goes. And Mahakashyapa was a figure in early Buddhism also. He's one of this group of great disciples. He was a bit older than most of them. He was really pretty badass, actually. He was known for deep ascetic practices and really understanding ethics and keeping the precepts very carefully. And so anyway, you might remember this story of Mahakashyapa receiving the transmission from Buddha. Case 6. Long ago, on Vulture Peak, Shakyamuni Buddha held up a flower before the assembly. That was like his whole Dharma talk, held up a flower. Everyone was silent. Only Venerable Mahakashyapa broke into a broad smile. Shakyamuni Buddha said, "I have the all-pervading true Dharma eye, the incomparable mind of Nirvana, the exquisite teaching of formless form, and the subtle Dharma gate. Not dependent on words and speech, a special transmission outside the sutras, this I have entrusted to Venerable Mahakashyapa." No, he never said that to me. So in Zen, that's how Mahakashyapa became the next ancestor. And since he had died, and Ananda was kind of, and in the Zen version of the story, Ananda is still working on it. He still doesn't quite get it. He doesn't have the thing with the pillow. So he then practices very closely for 20 more years with Mahakashyapa. The whole time, presumably, really, really, you know, working with his questions that he has, like, what am I missing? What do I not quite have here? And he's about to find out. He asks his teacher, "The world-honored one, the Buddha, transmitted to you the golden brocade robe. Did he give you anything else?" So in our tradition, realization is represented by symbols, right? We can't do anything without symbols. We're symbolic beings. And all, you know, the world is full of symbols and myths. And so the main symbol is the robe, and then usually the bowls too. They didn't put the bowls in this story, but just the robe. And maybe you were at Kate and Ewan's ordination last month, and so that's a really big moment, giving them the robe. So they sew this outer robe called Okesa, and they receive it in the ceremony and put it on for the first time in a formal way. So that's a very big deal in our tradition. And it's also just fabric, you know, came from the fabric store. They had to do a whole lot of work to it, put it together, sew it by hand. But it's also just a thing. So Ananda realizes this, right? He loves the robe, of course, and he loved the Buddha. Loved the Buddha so deeply. But he knows that's just a robe. What's the essence? You know, what else was there? And his teacher looks at him, and instead of trying to explain anything, calls to him, right? Calls to him. Just offers him a small, strong call, calling him by name. This story also appears in another collection of stories by Keizan Zenji. Stories of each of these transmissions from Buddha to his teacher. And I saw this story in there, and something about it really struck me, like this yes. Like, what was this yes about? You know, what is it to be called and really say yes? And so I sat with this question for a while, a year or two or something. And one time I was talking to Norman about it a lot. He was probably getting tired of hearing about it. And then one time at Samish, this thing about the flagpole somehow came to me. So let me give you the backstory on the flagpole. The last line, after he is called and says yes, the teacher, Mahakashyapa, says, knock down the flagpole at the gate. So apparently in ancient India, there was a whole system of religious debates. And the debating ground is like, you know, a sport, you know, that you could go watch. And in the debating ground, there are flags. They would run up the flags of each of the eminent teachers, and whoever wins, you know, their flag goes up higher or something like that. So flags would signal who was debating and who the winner was. And this practice of the formal debate lives on in the Tibetan tradition. Maybe you've seen images of the Tibetans practicing their debate like that, you know, when they make a point. And those are all kind of formalized and scripted, I understand, too. You memorize those. But anyway, so it should be, if you won the debate, that they just put up your flag or something like that. But here it's even more more different than that. It's not winning or losing. It's knock down the flagpole. You don't need the flagpole anymore. There's no putting your flag up and down. You don't need that. Knock it down. Or maybe another way of thinking about this is his teacher telling him, relax, you know? Stop trying to run your flag up there, you know? Oh, wait, knock it down, knock it down. So anyway, I was at Samish at Sesshin, and you know how in the wind, if there's no flag in the flagpole, it makes this kind of ding, 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 weird sound, you know? It's like a little bit annoying and you barely notice it. So I don't think there's actually a flagpole at Samish, but for some reason I was hearing this sound. Really like thinking about the story and sitting with Ananda saying yes, you know, and what is the flagpole? What is it? Oh, what is it? What is it? What is it? And I went in and I'm blabbing on about this, you know, all these thoughts and feelings I'm having, and is that really a flagpole I heard? And Norman actually interrupts me and says, Tim! And then somewhere I said, yes! And then he says, I remember this really clearly. Then he says, where's the next page? I remember what he said, but I want to not lose track what I wanted to say. Oh, yeah. He just looks at me for half a second, maybe, blank expression, and says, okay, no need to study that anymore. So then we were done with that. It's like Soto style, passing a koan. They don't announce your name at the end of the sesshin or anything. But anyway, that's just an aside. Your experience will differ. But I'd recommend practicing with this yes of Ananda. It's good to see your teacher and ask for practices, but we hear about practices too, so I want to share this practice with you, and you can play with it, or we can talk about it if you want to kind of get really into it, but let's try it out. So get yourself in some kind of meditation posture, whatever feels right now. So there are more, you know, there's a lot of different practices. Our core practices, as you know, are just pretty much just being present with the breath and the body, maybe counting the breath as a support. Maybe just holding that so lightly that there's nothing here, but just kind of an openness, an open awareness, just sitting, shikantaza. But from time to time, it's good to take up another practice, you know, with the support of your teacher, and so here's one of them. So just noticing the breath in the body, letting the body breathe you. And then at the very end of the exhale, silently inside your head, but with some energy, just say, yes. So try that, let's try that for a couple minutes. Inhaling with the exhale, it's like the yes just kind of drops into your heart, drops into your breath. Just exhaling, yes. giving yourself over to this yes. Thank you for trying that. Has a feeling to it, huh? Mm-hmm. A feeling to that, yeah. That feeling changes, you know. It's a practice of working with a phrase or a word. You just stay with it and you see where it takes you and find out what it is. But it's kind of like, in a way, just calling to yourself, right? Calling deeply to yourself. It's a little bit like this expression from Katagiri Roshi, settling the self on the self and letting your life flower bloom. Isn't that great? Settling the self on the self and letting your life flower bloom. Yes! And this calling and responding made me think of the wonderful Mary Oliver poem, the calling of the wild geese and the calling of the world. So let's appreciate that again. You've probably heard this many times, but it's always worth considering these some great works like this. So here's Wild Geese by Mary Oliver, and let's just focus on this sense of the world, the geese calling us. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. The world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. So the world offering itself to you, calling to you, harsh and exciting, over and over, you know, patiently calling to you. And I think the poem and the case remind us, though, that the calling itself is not enough. You know, that's not complete. The world's calls, or your life calling to you, it could just be landing on deaf ears. Or maybe you're kind of halfway hearing it, but don't quite listen, you know. Don't quite believe it, don't quite agree, you know. Oh, I don't agree with that. So the calls of the world by themselves are not enough. We need to show up. We need to actually really listen. We need to find out how to say yes. So I was thinking about this with a group earlier today. I asked them, and I could ask you too, I guess. Just think for a moment how your life ended up. Would you have predicted this? Right? Probably not, you know? Maybe maybe some little details, but the whole thing, like, you never could have predicted this. So somehow life called to you and you've been trying to answer all this time, huh? Disasters and problems and losses called to you. Joy and love called to you, right? Your many brilliant ideas called to you, you know? Some of them turned out not to be too brilliant after all. And somehow we are trying to answer, right? We've all, this whole, our whole life is nothing but Ananda, you know? Trying to answer, what is this, you know? How do I say yes to this? And we don't quite pull it off, we suffer, right? We know about that. And yet even in the suffering, there's some truth, you know? There's some feeling, there's something we're receiving, warm hand to warm hand from all of our teachers, and sometimes we don't recognize our teachers, you know? But they're always teaching us. So how's it been for you? What have you learned trying to answer the calls of the world when your teacher calls your name? So let's think about that. Let that be part of our conversation.